Welcome to the Declarations of War podcast. This is episode 34. Thanks for tuning in. Our host this time around are Alexia Card, it's myself, Ninja Turtle.
Hello.
And our other NAR director, Lintel.
Hey.
No special guest this week, but we have a big one coming next week. The one, the only, the founder of Mercenary Coalition, probably the most well-known mercenary ever to play Eve, Celine. Now, we're not going to be talking to him about any kind of CSM issues or anything like that, so don't really come in tuning for that, but what we will be talking about is stuff like the rise of MC, the fall of Band of Brothers, and a whole lot of Eve's most interesting history, so we hope you all join us for that. Just give some shout-outs here. I'd like to give a shout-out to Urzil99, Powers V2, Mean Hari, Benoit Gautier, Mark Scaris, Ari Danica, Seardred, and everybody else on TweetFleet talking up our Ripard Tag episode. There's been a lot of interesting comments. It has been pretty controversial. Some people are backing Ripard and saying that we've been defensive. Some people are backing us, saying Ripard was an idiot and short-sighted. Go listen to that podcast. See for yourselves. Join the discussion. Hashtag TweetFleet and the comments section on DeclarationsOfWar.com. Also want to give a shout out to the Nosy Gamer for making a transcript of one exchange in that interview and breaking it down for some analysis. It was a really cool idea for a blog post, and I wonder if we'll see other blog posts like that, either from him or other people. I would definitely be interested in reading them.
Hey guys, Turtle. I want to give a shout out to Goonswarm in general and Something Awful Forums for the charity drive that they have already gotten up and running for Vile Rat's widow and kids. An impressive amount of money being raised. So if you guys haven't donated to that yet, you probably should. We'll have a link to it in the show notes.
This is Lintel. I'd like to give a shout out to Cast Dyson, who spends so much of his time working with our Academy guys. It's just excellent.
Before we get into everything, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor for this podcast, Eve Time Code. They are probably the best place to buy plexes or time codes. They're really active in the community, supporting the community. Right now, they have a special, buy 14 time codes, get one free, evetimecode.com, where your business counts. There's a link to it on our website. Go check them out. If you would like to advertise on Declarations of War for your third-party service, your corp, your alliance, your business, contact Alexei of Card either through the forums at noirmerch.com or in-game. Let's get right into the news. Interesting stuff going on in Tribute. There have been a lot of grounds gained by the Clusterfuck Coalition, particularly the key strategic system of UMI, which allows them to project with a single Titan to pretty much every corner of Tribute. In response, the Dot Brothers Coalition has relocated to nearby Vale of the Silent, so they can both, you know, not get dropped on, like, constantly, and also that they can respond on the other end of their holdings, where Solar Fleet has been pushing in the Geminate region.
Yeah, Tribute looks like a big region when you're looking at it on Dotland, but actually it's a very, very small region. I'm not surprised that they can project with only one or a Titan in one place from there, because a lot of it's Vale of the Silent, a lot of it is Venal, and it all kind of runs into each other, but you know, technically Tribute is a very small region.
Yeah, it's very surprising. I mean, you look at it on, say, the influence map, the varied influence map, it looks like it's got a lot of spread, but that map can be very deceiving because it's all flattened out. From the sound of it, it sounds like it's very packed together in terms of light years. Branch also reminds me of that. There's another linchpin system up there, BKG. It said that if you take BKG, you take the region, which I guess UMI is the same thing for Tribute.
Yeah, it's not even really so much in a physical location that it's a choke point. There's another way into Venal. Really, the only place it cuts you out of is KQK and Pureblind.
They've still been doing some fighting, though. Despite being a little bit further away in terms of a staging base, Dot Brothers has still kept up their pattern of harassing Clusterfuck Coalition, so the CFC gains have not been as rapid as you'd think. They're definitely making a lot of headway, but it's still, I wouldn't describe it as a steamroll. Northern Coalition defense has been pretty stiff.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a steamroll either. And you know what the scary thing is Goonswarm is dropping Sov in all of these systems. Obviously, they don't want NCDOT to have it, but they're taking it in all these systems. Their Sov bills are going to be fucking huge when this war is over.
Yeah, but they still have all the tech moons to pay for it, so I don't think they're too worried about it.
In fact, they're taking NCDOTs, so they're going to have plenty of extra cash. I'm pretty sure they've already taken all the tech moons in tribute, or they're close to that objective as it is. Evoke is in an interesting spot with this. They're members of the OTEC Pact, so they're not going to attack any Goonswarm-held tech moons. They're not going to attack Goonswarm stuff, but they're still helping NCDOT defend their space. It's a really interesting political choice that they're making, and it seems like Goonswarm is giving them a lot of credit for doing it in a tactful way. They're not mad at them for backing up NCDOT as long as they adhere to their agreements by not attacking tech.
Yeah, that has kind of been my general impression of it too, is that Goonswarm welcomes somebody else on the other side to help bolster their good fights, but they know they could purge them as quickly as they're trying to purge NCDOT if, you know, Evoke ever made a move on their tech moons.
I think they also just appreciate good diplomacy. The leadership core of Goonswarm is not to be confused with Goonswarm's general membership, which tend to be, you know, disorganized, sort of a slice of everybody. You've got some really good players, you've got some new players, you've got some scammers, you've got some Eoner guys.
Some more scammers.
Some more scammers. It's a really varied group, but the leadership of Goonswarm is extremely capable, very focused, very organized. It's not a scattershot organization by any means, despite that it's large and there's such a variety of personalities and skill palettes and, you know, people doing different stuff. The leadership has a plan. The leadership implements that plan at all levels of the organization. It's actually pretty inspiring.
Now, you'd almost have to have good leadership with a group that big just to keep them all moving. Otherwise, Goons would have collapsed a long time ago.
That's a good point. Now, on the other side of the map, all the way down south, there have been some major developments in the Test Alliance versus AAA fight. Now, this, for those of us who haven't been following it, Test took Delve Quirius Period Basis, which is right on the edge of AAA space. They kicked out AAA allies, or, you know, at least partial allies. And they've sort of been staring at each other over the line. They're both entrenched, sort of like World War I-ish. there's an outpost on one system, there's a blank system, and there's an outpost next to that system controlled by the other side. And they just send fleets back and forth, hitting each other. AAA making more Sov plays, trying to take that outpost from Test. Test continually throwing them back at the last timer with the help of Pandemic Legion and the rest of the Honey Badger Coalition. It looks like this is going to start turning around. Test Alliance's finances, which they were putting up a substantial loss every month, having just taken all that Sov and having done all the ship replacement for that fighting, that's starting to stabilize. They're doing less ship replacements. They've got their moon production up and running. They've got Renners up and running. Pseudo-Renners, anyway. AAA, on the other hand, is in a weaker position. They're losing allies pretty damn fast. You got an Initiative, which is a curse-based alliance. Not close allies with AAA, but relatively friendly with them. And they have switched sides. They are now joining Test Alliance in the Honey Badger Coalition. Also, Raiden, which is essentially the entire supercap fleet for Band of Brothers, or a substantial portion of it. Now, it's not the most active alliance, but they're still big. They're still very powerful.
A lot of experience, too.
Mm-hmm. And rich.
Both those names carry a lot of weight with experience. They've both seen their share.
And AAA has not really treated its coalition too well. There have been a lot of TeamSpeak leaks of AAA fleet comms, their FCs getting mad. In particular, Makalu flipped out at a Red Alliance guy who was trying to stick it to AAA for making their allies repair in the staging station. Which, you know, from running an outpost as a business way back in the day in Providence. I don't see a problem with it, but I guess when you're in a coalition helping somebody fight and defend their space, making them pay for the privilege is sort of a rude dick move.
Well, you said it a couple times, or at least once on this podcast, but there is a big difference between the way AAA runs our coalition and the way TEST runs our coalition, and this is, you know, a clear example of it. And it's interesting, because the Russian bloc has been probably the most solid racial bloc in EVE. I think probably throughout its history, you've never really seen a lot of shakeups in the Russian bloc. You know, people going separate ways. It's not that they get along. It's not that they have common goals. But when it comes to it, they'll stand together. And we're starting to see this Russian bloc dismantled a little bit from the inside, nonetheless, too. Goonswarm's up to 10,000 members now, and they haven't been able to do it. It's been AAA that's dismantled their own Russian bloc.
Yeah, my largest corp in Red Alliance has left. They split ways, and I don't really blame them. They've lost their space big time. They moved to Quirius, then they got kicked out there, and the other Russians, at least AAA, aren't giving them a lot of consideration. Now, Red Alliance is a tough bunch with a tough core, but that's a lot of blows, you know, right in a row, and to then have your biggest ethnic ally sort of throw you under the bus a little bit. You know, that'd be hard, especially when you've been a stalwart fighting even after you've lost your space to try to defend theirs.
You know, AAA's always had that reputation, though. It's kind of, if you're not AAA, you're second class. And they've always treated their allies, at least from the time I've been in EVE, as second class. God help you if you're a runner.
Well, it's always been, what's their mantra? It's AAA against the world, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy when you act like this.
I think they used to be a little better at managing coalition, or maybe I was just, you know, looking at the past through rose-colored glasses. But Manfred Sidious and guys like that, I think they were better at, even if they didn't really feel like their other allies were equal, and let's be honest, AAA is an extremely active PvP alliance that can run huge fleets by itself. All its allies sort of are second class, except maybe for Stainwagon. So, that's one thing. But you don't want to tell your allies that you think they're shit and that they can't match up to you. You want to make them feel, you know, included so they keep coming to your fleets. I think old school AAA, or at least relatively, not old school Evil Thug, but a little bit after that, I think they were better at communicating to the other allies, making them feel like everything was on the same page. Well, we'll see how this goes here. I mean, to me, from my perspective, the invasion of Catch is pretty much imminent. I can see no other reason why Raiden would join with Test Alliance, Please Ignore, unless Test said, hey, you're going to get AAA space. There's no other way an alliance that big with that kind of history, that antagonistic history with TEST and the HBC CFC, there's no way they would jump without some major incentive. So I think you're going to see Initiative take over their old Initiative space, the space they used to have before AAA retook it. So AAA had the space, lost the space, Initiative moved in, or was moved in by the Drone Russians, and AAA came back to take it. I think you will see probably Tenerifus Immensi or something like that will go to Initiative Mercenaries, and probably Catch Impasse will go to Raiden. That's my prediction.
If that is right, and they do move into Catch will be an awesome war over the winter. It is a ginormous region, very complex geographically, and AAA will fight like hell to keep it because they wanted it.
I disagree, actually.
You think AAA is going to pull back to Stain like they usually do when Catch gets invaded, or?
Well, I've watched AAA get invaded by a big force twice now. And both times, they'll put up defense for maybe two or three systems, usually like two systems, and they'll see how that goes. And if they're constantly getting blobbed there, they will pull everything back to LGK in Stain, which is their ancestral home. essentially. And they will wait until the attacking force grinds through that entire region and then installs weak alliances there. And then once the blob disperses, AAA will then reinvade and kick the weak alliances out and then reestablish their territory.
But see, that's the thing, is they're not installing weak alliances there. They're going to be installing Initiative or Raiden. If I was AAA, I would be looking at this as the last chance. That plan worked the last two times. The people that are going to be coming into your space now are not going to be pushovers, and you very well might not have the chance to take it back for quite some time.
I agree on that one, especially if during the course of catch falling, AAA continues to push allies away. The only reason they retook their space the last time is they have really gone the extra mile to make sure that their blues were staying with them and moved with them in Stain so that they were with them for the take back. And I agree with you that these alliances aren't going to be weak pushovers. Initiative, back when they took space from AAA alongside PL and the drone guys, it was a very different alliance back then. They've gotten a lot smaller, a lot smarter, a lot harder. And I think AAA will have some trouble if they let them, you know, get Sino Jammers and things like that. But we'll see. Maybe AAA will turn around and fight this time. If they do, I think we'll see a similar situation like we're seeing up north, where there's big blob coming in, but there's a very principled, highly skilled small group resisting them, not winning every fight, but costing them dearly every inch.
And making timers worth every second, too, and, you know, running stations 6, 7, 8 timers. And just making the other guys bring ships out so that you can give them those egregious losses.
Yep, it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, Ketch is an awesome region when war envelops it, and I'm really hoping that AAA will stand and make this a final stand, because, like I said, I don't think they're going to get it back. Speaking of friendly CFC people, Get Off My Lawn was heisted to the tune of $46 billion. And I'm a little depressed because that doesn't really seem like all that much. They had 9 systems worth of sovereignty dropped out in Pure Blind, but that's Pure Blind, so...
It was picked right back up, too, so it's not like a major loss for them.
Well,
that
yeah,
seems
I mean,
like a really impulsive move from the thief, because 46 bill, I mean, that's not even enough for a Titan.
No, from what I garner, it was just kind of like a little snap butthurt decision or something, getting into an argument with leadership and took what you can get your hands on and, you know, drop Sov for the ha-ha.
Not much of a ha-ha either, because nothing really came of it. Like Lintel said, they just turned around and took it right back. It wasn't like he coordinated with NC Dot to, you know, create an opportunity for them to take some systems from CFC and force them to backpedal and fight on two fronts. Nothing like that.
No. The Sov was picked back up in, it looks like, 8 hours, 7.5. So, I mean, it wasn't even that big of an issue. It bare inconvenience, if.
Well, yeah,
if
I mean,
that
nobody,
much.
Nobody was going to go in to Pure Blind and be opportunistic about that one, but.
Much more interesting than lame attempts at corp theft. There have been some huge ass small gang fights that were really cool to watch, and they made their way onto YouTube. Verge of Collapse took on IRC with about 4-1 odds and came out on top. Verge of Collapse, of course, the Alliance Tournament 10 winners and noted wormhole residents. They were in Cobalt Edge thanks to a wormhole, and they had 2 triage carriers available. They put one in, put their Tech 3 fleet out there. Fucking IRC just warped a Drake/Hurricane fleet literally right on top of them and never bothered to move the scimitars out of range. Derp. And they got owned along with a few of their own carriers. At one point, the Verge of Collapse triage carrier's about to die. It jumps back through the wormhole and they sign the second one in. Hilarious.
I did watch that first one there, and, yeah, it was an amazing fight. The FC was really calm, really collected, and, you know, they knew what they were doing. I will say, when you say 4-1, the odds weren't 4-1, I don't think. The numbers were definitely 4-1, but I would give Verge of Collapse much better odds than 4-1 against IRC.
I principally agree, but when I say 4-1, I'm talking like there was like 200 or something IRC guys. Like, it was a huge enemy fleet where you would think their ships would just get alpha'd right through, or that they wouldn't be able to break the enemy logistics. But it really didn't seem to be a problem. I think they lost, like, what, a guardian? And maybe some dictors?
Yeah, I think they... I don't know. I vaguely remember they might have lost a guardian the first time they jumped in, or maybe even not. Because they jumped in that first time, reapproached the gate just to see what kind of DPS that fleet was putting out, and...
Well, all those guardians survived. There was a comment in the video that they finally lost one ship or something like that. They almost lost the triage carrier, but like I said, it went through the wormhole, which, unlike gates, allows you to jump with aggression. Similarly, Rooks and Kings took on a massive CVA fleet, pretty much the same proportions of fighting outnumbered, also with triage carriers, except this time we got to see some tracking dreads in the Rooks and Kings fleet. And it was a really solid fleet comp from CVA. They had pretty much Hellcat Abaddons with proper logistics support. I honestly don't know what they did wrong. They just got ripped apart. I think maybe the dreads might have been simply too much for them. Certainly the Rooks and Kings triage carrier tanked like a champ.
Don't expect anything less from Rooks and Kings.
I know, right? We got lucky enough to see the video from CVA's point of view. So the triage carrier is the primary target, obviously. You get to see his armor status. And he pretty much stays at about one-third armor for the entire fight. It's really impressive considering the number of ships that were shooting at him. Easily over 100 battleships, I think.
Experience, it's the key.
Yep.
Someday. We got to see the new destroyer hulls, the Kaldari and the Mimitar one. I love the Kaldari. Mimitar, not so much. What do you guys think?
I hope they redo the Mimitar, but yeah, the Kaldari one looks very nice. I think I'm going to have to buy like 10 when they first come out.
Yeah, I kind of wish it wasn't a destroyer, because now I don't really have a use for it.
Drunk Rome one night.
Yeah. It looks like a little submarine, though, like a U-boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the Minmatar, I was a little taken aback by the Minmatar one, just because it didn't... It looked like somebody took a shrink ray and, like, hit a cyclone or something, because it's got the fans up front, you know, but it's this tiny little ship. I was more dismayed by the fact that it kind of looked like the Kaldari one, and I hope we're not going to see a class of ships that all look kind of similar, you know, in design, where that's kind of a thing EVE has been getting away from with the V3 textures and remodeling ships. You know, racial aesthetics are definitely adhered to, and I hope they don't make all these destroyers look the same.
What elements of the design did you see common?
General shape and form, you know, the kind of... The Minmatar one looked like a submarine to me, too, I'll be honest.
To me, it looks more like an ironclad from back in the Civil War days, but you can kind of see where both of them were influenced along similar lines. But, I mean, one comes out looking beautiful, and the other one comes out looking like a pile of dog crap.
Yeah.
Minmatar always looks like dog shit, because that's how Minmatar's always looked. Well,
not always.
I disagree on the dog shit.
The Vagabond looks beautiful.
Now.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, I disagree on the... On the dog shit thing, the new Vagabond is amazing.
Yeah, well, but that their new destroyer I just wish it had extended to the destroyer setup, because that just looks horrible.
I will recant my statement then and say that most Minmatar ships are released looking like dog shit and then are eventually remodeled and nice.
I love the new Vagabond. It's finally getting its frills back. It looks incredible. And I can't wait. I actually... I don't like the Vagabond. I like the Vagabond. I don't like the fact that it seems that people cannot, for the life of them, fly it and keep it alive, which is why we're doing a masterclass segment dedicated to the Vagabond at the end of the show. But I will admit, I trained Tech 2 autocannons. I think I'm about 9 days away. So I will be in a Vagabond by the time the frill patch goes live.
Yeah, and 10 get you one, somebody's still gonna derp the stupid thing.
Well, vagabonds die. I mean, that's what they do. They're not the toughest ships by any stretch of the imagination.
All right, let's put a pin on the vagabond discussion for that section. Some besides the visuals of the Kaldari, the Mimitar Destroyer, the Vagabond, we're getting a lot of overhauls for ships in terms of their stats. Bonuses, slot layout, statistics, hit points, everything is on the table, and CCP's balancing efforts are way, way, way ahead of schedule. Thanks in part to the pressure of the CSN to get them to really prioritize ship balancing as a good way to get us content while we're waiting for features to catch up with EVE's technical debt, and definitely in large part to the addition of CCP Fozzie to the balance team, which has allowed them to do a lot more. We are now, instead of looking at frigates being almost done by the time winter came around, maybe more, a little bit more than half done, we are now seeing frigates finished, and we're talking about cruisers now, and it is entirely possible that not only will cruisers be finished by the winter patch, but we might even get one or two more things in there as well. They are looking great.
It's a cool change of mindset to see in CCP, because ship balancing in the past had kind of fallen either into A, it's something we really have to work into the development cycle, and so it was something that kind of got pushed into a schedule based on other things, or it was B, we have like 3 seconds left before this patch, let's try and work something out. And it's cool to see them take this kind of independent yet really straightforward approach to it, bringing on extra guys, making it a development priority, but not tying it so strictly into the winter development cycle that it becomes strapped for time or strapped for resources.
Of all the ships coming out, I think people are most excited about the logistics frigates and the logistics cruisers, the Tech 1 logistics cruisers. The frigates are a brand new thing. We've never had a remote repping frigate before, and this was entirely a child of the CSM. CCP had an idea of what to do with these ships, but without going into too much detail on what it was, pretty much just more of the same with what you would get with some of the other frigates they were already rebalancing, like the Tormentor versus the Punisher versus combat frigates are combat frigates. You can have one or two that do different things, but honestly, this one just wasn't different enough. There wasn't anything really unique about it, so we were bullshitting around, and Hans and I were talking about frigate fights and frigate fighting, and logistics frigates came up, and the other CSM sort of jumped in this discussion, and we were talking about what would make it work and what would make it balanced, but also make it interesting enough for players to want to use. And then we approached CCP with the idea, and after a couple days of pressuring them, they sort of got behind the idea. At first they thought no one would bother using them, but after talking about a range bonus and after talking about the benefit they would have for destroyer and assault frigate fleets, it became pretty clear that these things might have a role. So now we're going to get these frigates with about a 24-kilometer rep range. They're going to be a little on the slow side, but still fast enough to keep up with your assault frigates, which will be a great addition to frigate combat in EVE. Cannot wait to see the roaming gags running around with these things.
As long as Goonswarm are flying noob ships, there will always be a place for logistics frigates.
Forget goons. We might be able to squeeze them into RAF gangs.
I would love them for Empire fighting. Just roll frigate fleets, 40, 50, 60 jumps, who gives a fuck? You can do two of those roams in a single night with frigates. That'd be fantastic. And not only are the logistics frigates coming in, the pretty much never used logistics cruisers, really the only one that's ever used is the Osprey, now they're getting completely redone. They will only be able to use medium reps, but they will still have ranges that come close to approaching the Tech 2 logistics cruiser ranges, which means if you're, into running logistics with your fleets, you could now have these Tech 1 ships with the Tech 2 ships. You don't have to worry about, them lagging behind or being too close to the fleet or not being able to project reps far enough. They'll be projecting reps just as far as your Tech 2 ships, just not as much of them, and they won't be as durable. So there's still an advantage for the Tech 2 ship, but now you can bring this Tech 1 ship and not have to feel like you're shitting up your fleet, which I think is a big step.
Yeah, and it's going to make that transition into those T2 Logi fleets a lot easier also, because right now, like you said, nobody uses the T1 version, so it's a huge culture shock when you become a logistics pilot in the fleet fight. You're trying to figure out what the hell you're supposed to be doing, and this is going to help ease a lot of people into that role.
Godsend for Nor Academy, I'll tell you that much.
Yes, they now only have 3 acceptable ships to fly. The Logi frigates and cruisers, the interceptors and the bombers. That's it.
Some other highlights, you know, we're not going to go into everything, but the Bellicose is getting a complete redo. It actually makes it look kind of badass. The Celestis is finally getting some love. It's going to be able to tank more and damp harder. Damp's obviously being extremely underpowered. So we are finally going to see the Celestis getting a little loving, with probably a stronger bonus to allow it to damp more effectively. Still probably going to be the weakest of the electronic warfare types, but definitely better than it is now. And the other end of it, I believe, is the Omen is getting some much-needed love with its fittings, so it can actually be a competitive damage cruiser.
Yeah, fitting an Omen's like trying to fit a Caracal. You just end up crying.
I think the Caracal's also getting a little love as well.
Yay! Now, if, you know, oh great and powerful CSM rep, if you could fix the EAF frigates, that would be beautiful.
We've been asking. CCP is very much this. They want to do frigates, and they want to do cruisers, then battle cruisers, then battleships, then they're going to start looking at the Tech 2 things. The CSM has been telling them over and over and over and over and over again, please, 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 if there's time, will you look at electronic attack frigates and Black Ops? Now, we're probably not going to know if that's going to be able to be possible until we get closer to the winter expansion, but we're all hoping, and every time it comes up, we're keep pressing them to take a look at these underused ships.
That would just be beautiful.
Let's move on to contract wrap-ups. Nar is now back on contract. We finished our grinding goal, and it's on.
I don't think we ever mentioned our grinding goal, to be honest. We haven't done a show in September yet.
It was horrible.
That might be true. So we took a pause to grind up some money. We needed to pay Jared for some stuff. We needed to replace some ships, or wanted to try to start saving up for a Titan, but that became readily apparent that we can't really grind fast enough for that one. So we took a little break to just do some straight NPCing, some straight incursion running, but we're back on the job now. And we had a contract in Providence, the Y-MPWL entry system, and it was fantastic.
Oh yeah, that was a fun fight. We had a little bit of trouble with the scout sitting on the gate with us constantly, but we still got kills. So apparently people don't know how to read local.
Yeah, 92% efficiency. That's pretty good for a NullSec contract. You can't complain. Something good to point to for prospective employers.
Yep. In fact, our 5 losses, total of 0.28 billion, okay, 280 mil, were all NAR Academy guys.
And to be fair, 4 of those losses, no, 3 of those losses were in the middle of a fleet fight, and I think that was the first time some of them have actually been in that situation, where we had a local spike of about 30, and then they jumped straight to us. So I was very impressed with them. They did a really good job.
Yep. My only complaint with that, it was so short. I actually only got to play one night out of the contract. We were only hired for a weekend. Total of 47 kills, 3.27 bill in damage. As Turtle said, efficiency, 92.12%.
My only other complaint would be when voice comms went to complete and total crap when we had a freighter warp directly into one of the warp bubbles. But I will, you know, allow that.
All of a sudden, jizz in my pants started playing over vent, and you're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Only in Providence, people. Only in Providence.
Yeah, you had the usual gate camp bullshit going on vent, and then utter silence and just random people screaming, get points, get points.
Nor Academy is now recruiting. We are looking for smart players who are looking to learn small gang PvP in an immersive training environment. In a program designed for new pilots as well as grizzled 00 vets, learn the ins and outs of Merc life, including efficiency and ethics, hostile nullsec survival skills, FCing, and more. As one of Eve's oldest and most respected mercenary outfits, Noor runs a tight ship, but we always strive to have fun doing it. If you want to be part of a high-end Merc PvP organization that always strives to be better tomorrow than it is today, Noor is the place for you, and Noor Academy is the place to start. Apply today through our forums at noormercs.com.
This week in Mercs, former Noor Mercenary Group members Gisk, Mineshaft, Interstellar Schuldner, which is a German corp, they've risen to power within their alliance. We were talking about them earlier. Germanic powerhouse and OTEC member Evoke, the successor to Sweet Julie, our beloved friend, who's apparently quit the game a couple months ago. The guy's name is René Krych, or Krych, K-R-Y-C-H. He is now one of Evoke's top leaders, so congratulations to those guys. It's nice to see him get a promotion. They were a really solid group of dudes, Sergato aside. And we wish them the best, and good luck with the fighting up north.
Yeah, another group to mention, I guess, would be the Vengeance Incorporated Bomber's Bar guys.
Absolutely.
Just taking random people and going out and having a whole lot of fun with them. I've managed to go out a couple times with them, and I think some of the other Noor guys have, and it's just a blast. It's completely different from how we fly, but it's a lot of fun, and I would recommend it to anybody.
Why don't you give a brief overview of what the project actually is for maybe people that don't know?
All right. Basically, it's a chat channel called Bomber's Bar and Eve, and you join up, and they run fleets at least twice a day, sometimes more, and they've got it posted in the MOTD. And you join the fleet, they tell you where to rally at, and sometimes it's a hot drop. Well, you know, you form up on your Black Ops battleships and bridge in, shoot stuff in the face, and other times you just punch into a system and just totally rape it. So, they put together...
And to be clear, the Bomber's Bar, they are actually frequently launching bombs, doing these amazing large-scale bomb runs, killing hundreds of ships at once.
Oh yeah, their FCs have it down to a science. It's a beautiful thing to watch.
There's definitely something to be said for an FC that can pick up a group of randoms and, you know, run them successfully, especially with something as complicated as a bomb run. Granted, you know, changes to things like cloak and not decloaking, you know.
The cloak change definitely made something like Bomber's Bar possible. I don't think there would be any way to do it if the ships were decloaking each other like they used to. But I went to their fleet yesterday, and they really do have it down to a science. I mean, they have a guy that'll give you the bombs, they have a guy that'll give you the bookmarks. All you need to do is plug the bookmarks in, plug the bombs in, and make sure you're listening to the FC. And I, from my point of view, I think from the business side of things, Bomber's Bar, while it is a great fun thing, it's also the best promotional tool a group like Vengeance Inc. could possibly ask for. So they're doing these amazing bomb runs, people are talking about it, people are putting up these YouTube videos about it, and that's going to turn around and generate contracts for them down the line.
Yeah, I think they have their first post on the Evo forums where they're accepting contracts now, too. And part of their advertising is those YouTube videos. They've linked it straight into their thread.
It's not, you know, bombers are not a bad way for mercs to get into nullsec. There's not a lot of easy ways to do nullsec contracts anymore, and bombers by no means easy, but it's one of the ways that, you know, a small group like them, or even us, can get into nullsec and run effective contracts, especially when they're spitting out bomb runs like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been doing it for a while, and it's difficult to get down, but once you have it down, you see amazing results from these cheap ships. It's kind of impressive to see them do these things.
Bombers, my anti-blob. Alright, moving on. Let's get into some CSM coverage. I'm almost afraid to be talking about it, but I guess it needs to be done, since it did make a lot of headlines. There was an attempt at getting the voting reform discussion off of the CSM forums, off of the CSM summit minutes, and putting it out to the public to get the player community involved. And it did not go well. We had Trevor Dadu put out the best proposal we could think of to start things off. And people took it as the God's word or whatever, like a decree from on high. And it contained some controversial provisions that would limit the power of organized voting blocks. And predictably, Goonswarm, Honey Badger Coalition, all those guys swarmed onto the thread and pretty much shredded it. It was a very frustrating situation to deal with. CSM members were like, this is really just a discussion point. We hear what you're saying about these provisions. They don't have to be in the final thing. Let's talk about what you would like to see. And that message got lost in the sea of people seeing red and just being really angry at everything. And that went on for like 60 pages. Until finally, there's a second thread started that got a little more civil. And then finally a third thread officially started by CCP Xhagen, who is the CSM guru of CCP. And he kicked off the discussion, and that one was far more productive, and people saw it as a much more legitimate effort with a CCP staff person starting it off, rather than someone who's already sitting on the council. So, hopefully we'll get some good movement out of this. There was a lot of good ideas and good feedback on the third thread. And, I mean, voting reform is going to be happening. There are a few changes, even if the basic structure doesn't change. There are a few additions to make the voting system a little more mature. And I think we'll see, you know, some kind of way to protect, say, a Mitanni-like situation. Or if, God forbid, someone in the CSM that gets elected does pass away or is hurt or gets drafted or for whatever reason can't take office before the term actually starts. Some way of handling that situation. That's my personal goal to have that. And there are a few other things worthwhile as well, like improving voter turnout by more splash screens, letting candidates run ads, that sort of thing.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but, I guess this is more of a question. Does the CSM see voter reform as an integral part of the stakeholdership? Because that would kind of seem to go in tandem to me if you're gonna put the CSM in a position where they could be or are affecting things at CCP, you would want something like voting reform because I think the outcome is almost obvious, inevitable.
I don't want to speak for everybody, but I get the sense that we're not looking at it as a stakeholder issue per se. Although, like you said, being stakeholders and the game-changing effects that's going to have for the CSM, next CSM, CSM after that, it definitely makes the importance of having an active, diverse, and really knowledgeable council all that much more important. So definitely the driving voters to the polls and getting them educated about what the CSM is and why it's important, what their candidates that are offering, you know, what they're offering, what they're standing for, where they come from, what to look for in a good CSM rep. All those sorts of questions, you know, are sort of coming up, but as far as the actual process, I don't think we see it as a stakeholder thing. It's just another thread of discussion as far as what the CSM is, how it acts, and how it's elected. It's something that we've just needed to have. We're using the same voting system now we were back when the CSM was just an idea and they put it into the white paper. There's an opportunity for the player community to really get in there, and now that we've had experience with the council, with these elections, to look at it and see, can we do something better than this CCP handed down, essentially starter system? Now, if the end of that is providing all these opportunities for candidates to better promote themselves and better promote the election in general as part of, you know, this election reform thrust, I think that's a good thing. And there were some fantastic ideas about how to do that on that thread, and we're going to see which of those CCP will be willing to commit to.
Is this something CCP is behind?
Absolutely. X Hagen really believes this was a conversation that needed to happen, and we decided to be the CSM that said, okay, you know, maybe now's time. And it's not a new thing. We've been talking about how the CSM's elected and how the CSM functions for a while, particularly the transition between CSM 5 and CSM 6, where the CSM took on a completely different role, and now CSM 6 to CSM 7, where that role is maturing and becoming institutionalized and sort of going to the next level with the stakeholdership. You know, it's a time of change and improvement and maturity. And, you know, maybe it was premature of CSM 7 to go, okay, maybe we should start talking about the voting system now. Maybe that was something for CSM 8 or CSM 9. But, you know, we made the call with X Hagen, say, okay, let's go ahead and start talking about this with the players. For a lot of people did it with different reasons. You know, Traber has his reasons of why now is the time, or that this conversation needs to happen. I have my own reasons. Mostly, I think the thing that really kicked it for me was the Mitanni. Being elected, dealing with that chaos of having him pulled out, starting the term with that controversy, starting the term shorthanded, definitely seemed like something needed to be done so that was handled more elegantly later. And if that was a reason to have a broader conversation about the system in general, okay.
It was unfortunate because, like, when all that Mitanni stuff started going on, I mean, there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell of anything the CSM was thinking or saying or doing was ever going to get, you know, Eve's attention. I mean, everybody was just focused on that issue. But you know what? I totally agree with you. Now is the time, because it's probably going to take you a while to figure it out, and this isn't something you want to be looking at, you know, 2 or 3 months before the election. This is something that needs to be put in place. So 2 or 3 months before the election, everybody's read the finalized rules.
Right. So everybody's on the same page, definitely. And most people seem relatively happy with how things are. You know, the changes that will be made, if there are going to be any, probably will not be as radical as some people are tinfoiling about on the forums, or just legit being mad about on the forums. Probably not going to be as controversial as Robert's initial proposal. Probably not even going to be huge changes, but there's definitely improvements to be made, and I'm hoping some of the voter education / candidate advertising stuff goes through as well. It just seems like a cool thing to do, you know, allow candidates to buy, say, splash ads, which they could use for attack purposes or just to promote themselves. I think that's a very Eve fun thing. Move on. As you may have noticed, listener, we have a brand new declarationsofwar.com. We've been wanting to do a more robust podcast presence for a long time, but, you know, some metrics about how many people were actually listening to the podcast. We had a bigger audience than I really expected before we started doing proper analytics. And there was a lot of demand from people on the forums and elsewhere that the CSM's communication efforts be a little more prominent. And since I'm on the CSM, and even if I wasn't, we'd still be doing CSM coverage segments as a way to help the CSM communicate to the player base, I just figured it's the thing to do. So we took the plunge. Turtle and Jared put a lot of work into setting up the site, and it is amazing. So I wanted to go over a couple features. Obviously, we wouldn't have time to do this with the Ripard Tag Edition, but you know, now that hopefully you've listened to that and are now listening to this, you can check out our Declarations of War site. We've got Twitter, we've got iTunes, we've got a proper RSS feed that you can use. You donate if you like. There's a great poll option that we're going to be using for show polls We're going to take a show poll based on something controversial during the show, and we'll talk about it on the next episode. See how you guys think about it. Currently, at least at the time of this recording, it's Technetium Alchemy. Ripard Tegg made the case that the patch to Technetium Alchemy and other R32 alchemies actually made things worse in terms of trying to get tech fixed and in terms of conflict drivers in EVE. Whereas I and the rest of the CSM members argued it was a step in the right direction, although obviously not the fix. So we're throwing it out to you guys. Go vote. Tell us what you think. If the poll is closed by the time this gets out, my apologies. Check out the results. We have a past polls tab where you can go do that. We've also got a past guest tab where you can check out special guests that have appeared, what episodes they've appeared on, and their websites and Twitter. About us, you can check out a cast page where we've got some brief bios about the regular cast members you'll see on Declarations of War. You can check out evetimecode.com with our Plex link. There's a recruitment link if you're interested in joining NAR. We'll take you right to the forums. We've got information about sponsoring. We've got a proper comment system where you can actually make an account, log in, and sign up, and it's not a big to-do. Just a whole bunch of things that have really been long overdue. So, Turtle, I don't know if you want to say anything else about it.
No, that pretty much covers it. We've been getting a lot of response off Twitter, you know, for things like the iTunes feed and the RSS feedback. And these were all... The RSS feed was something, you know, we had with the front page functionality, and we had to make do with a shitty situation there for a couple of months with, you know, how we had to host the podcast and the website and the medium. And we finally got it figured out. Yay.
Yay. Yeah, so it looks great. Jared really put the extra effort in to get the visuals looking nice. And Turtle set up the whole WordPress. I wrote up a lot of the content. It was a really collaborative team effort, and I think it turned out great. And hopefully you guys do too.
And if you don't, fuck you.
And there's Ninja Turtle with our usual politically correct statement.
And finally, let's talk about the Vagabond. This is a Noir Masterclass segment. Our last Masterclass, I believe, was on the Kitsune and the other electronic attack ships. Masterclass is where we go in and we take a ship or take a tactic, break it down for you with some really experienced PvPers, go beyond basic fitting, and really talk about tactics and some interesting variations on these fits to how to get the most out of your ship you possibly can and how to build a cool fleet around it. So, the Vagabond, scourge of our killboard. This is possibly one of the most lost ships ever in NAR. Not anything to do with the ship. I mean, it's a good ship. It's a great ship. It's got the most escapability of any cruiser. But its range is so close, you have to fight under 24, 27 kilometers to really be effective, that unless you're really watching it, you're going so fast, then you might screw up, get into newt range, and just not be able to get out again. Once you're caught, you're dead.
Yeah, that's the key there. It's one of those ships that is kind of, you can only really fly it one way, and your options are pretty limited. It's either A, kill something now, or B, leave now. Slot layout is definitely reminiscent of a Minmatar ship. 6 high slots, 4 mids, and 5 lows. Gives you that jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none kind of feel. The bonuses are built for speed, and they're built for your projectile weapons. Minmatar Cruiser is going to bring you 5% to your turret rate of fire and 5% to your max velocity. Heavy Assault Ship is 10% to your fall-off range, 5% to damage. That 10% fall-off range, probably the biggest bonus you're going to get out of the Vaga. It allows you to project any sort of DPS at range. So Heavy Assault Ship 5, great idea for this ship. Minmatar Cruiser 5, you should probably just have that anyways.
And it's also must be said that it has 25 M3 of drone bay, giving you a pretty decent option of anti-frigate support with like Warrior 2s or Hobgoblins, or some ECM drones to disrupt heavier ships. The traditional way to fly the Vagabond is micro warp drive fit, and either an extender invuln or 2 extenders, a point, and then your low slots are gyrostabs, tracking enhancers, and either a nanofiber, damage control, or a PDU, depending on what kind of guns you're fitting and whether you need more durability or more speed. Highs are very much autocannons, You know, they got great range projection, good tracking, good damage output, pretty much everything you need in a Vagabond.
I've only flown it a few times, usually on an alt, but I love the boat. It's not very forgiving. If you screw up once, you're pretty much fucked. But that being said, with the new ASPs, you do have some versatility in the fitting. We played around with one version of it the other day, and it was just... Oh, I had to go change my pants about 5 times.
Yeah, this is the a fit that's been popping around NOR recently. The dual prop ancillary shield boosted Vagabond.
Leave my baby alone.
I actually think it's a cool fit. You got the Vagabond, it goes about 900 meters a second with the afterburner. So you put the smallest caliber medium auto cannon you can in the highs, which gives you a shorter range, but you're fighting up close, so you don't really need more. You do an extra large shield booster and then normal lows, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, we took it out the other day. We took 3 of them, 2 long point, 1 short point, and we took it against about an 8-man gang with Logi. They had Logi support and we didn't, and we just raped them. We just plowed through their Logi, and then we tackled one of their heavier ships, and it went down, and the rest of them just ran.
The interesting thing about the dual prop bag, for me, is if you put a scram on it. Now, obviously, if you have multiple of these ships, you should coordinate with one another, whether you have a long point, scram, or web, so you make sure that you're balanced there. But if you've got the scram, you can go in, get your point, start fighting. If it looks like you're not going to win, you're scramming them. You've got 900 meters a second with the afterburner. You can get outside of scram range, and then once you kick your micro warp drive on, you're the fastest cruiser in the game. So unless you were dueling a frigate and losing, which is unlikely with an ancillary shield booster, you're pretty much home free. So it's got some great escapability. I think the only real problem would be if you get neutered to hell and back and can't get out.
Yeah, well, we were rocking 220s, and we managed to squeeze medium newts on it, so they were trying. They had a cane on the field trying to newt us, and we were just newting him right back. So we pretty much own the field.
In a fleet role, the Vagabond normally acts as a heavy tackler for us. So he'll run in there, usually with a long point. Once the interceptor gets initial tackle, you throw the Vaga on it, and then it doesn't matter if the interceptor is getting chased by warriors or whatever, because the Vaga has it, and the Vaga fears no drone, basically.
Yeah. And when you support it with... once you support it with logistics, you're not getting rid of it. It's not an interceptor. You can't chase it off. It's not another normal heavy... It's not a normal tackle cruiser. So you're not going to outrun it. There's nothing you can do but sit there and pray to God you get reinforcements. It's just a beautiful boat.
Well, the thing, the counter to the VAG is, of course, the neutralizer and long-range webs. So if a rapier decloaks and can slow your Vagabond down before you can warp off, then you might get dogpiled on. And you have an okay tank, but the resists aren't that great. Your effective hit points are not that high. So your Logi might be able to keep you up, but as you're talking about larger and larger type fleet engagements, that's not going to become as much of an option. The best thing to do with your Vagabond, because you go so fast, is simply not get caught, which the Vagabond can do probably better than any ship in the game.
Yeah, the only time I've seen us derp Vagas in the fleet support role is when, for whatever frickin' reason, they decide to switch to short-range ammo and try to become DPS boats, and that's not their job.
Yeah, unless you're doing that dual-prop ASB Vaga thing, I would not recommend closing at any point below 20 kilometers for any reason.
The Vagabond definitely fills an amazing role as a secondary tackle. It does not have the in-warp speed of an interceptor, so pairing it up with an interceptor is a great way to run. I love using them in Empire, kind of like quick fleet hunter-killer roles. You pair it up with an interceptor catches your first tackle. Well, it's, may have to bug out, but now you've got a Vagabond in proper orbit with a long point on it, and now that guy's in a little bit more trouble.
Yeah. Hell yeah. The other common use is a for lack of a better term, a point defense ship, sort of what you'd imagine destroyers doing. But the Vagabond does it just as good, if not better, where you've got it paired with some sniper ships, and any time, say, a tackle frigate comes in, the Vagabond charges out a little bit and picks them off. Because of the high tracking of the autocannons, because of the high speed it can keep up with the targets, it's a very effective frigate killer, and God help anything that comes into its effective range trying to go after another target, because it'll stop it and it'll kill it pretty quick.
Yeah, and that in that situation, you would fit it with the Scrambler instead of the Disruptor, correct? If you're running.
No, you would still go with the Disruptor. The difference is not so much in the fitting as the piloting, where the Heavy Tackle Vaga is up 20 to 24 from the primary target. The Point Hunter Vaga is back a bit, probably about, if you assume your snipers are at 100-ish, you want to put your Hunter Killer Vaga, your Frigate Killer Vaga, like 75 away from the target, so it can catch things that are coming in and protect your recons, your logistics, and all that stuff. And it will frequently close with frigates to neut them, as opposed to scramming them down, but it still wants to have that long point so that it can prevent them from warping off, and it can act as a backup tackle if it really has to switch roles.
Well, and the general idea there, too, is when you have a fleet of sniper ships that's maybe, say, 100, 120k off of something, the second the other fleet gets a guy on top of you, they have something to warp to, so that buffer, that 25, 30k in between them and your sniper fleet is that buffer so that they don't end up getting a warp in on top of your snipers.
For sure. I would actually love to see the dual prop Vaga in that hunter killer role. I think it might be interesting. It's got that high tracking with the dual 180s, which is good for against frigates. And of course, fighting a frigate, you probably expect to get scrammed back, but you can easily keep up with their afterburners, with the Vagabond's afterburners. So that'd be a really interesting thing to do. The only concern I have would be the vulnerability to alpha strikes, which, if you're fighting in the kinds and sizes of fleets that snipers tend to operate, could be a legit problem.
Yeah, basically you're relying on that ASB, and you pulse it once, and that refills your entire shield. But the only issue we saw when we were trying it solo against the fleet is the DPS is the standard for a Vaga, so you're going to be a little bit light when it comes to going after anything above a cruiser. So once you put those ASBs, dual props, in groups of three or so, there's pretty much nothing you can't chew through. But when you're by yourself, you need to be very careful with your target selection.
Well, that's always true for the Vaga.
Yeah, but some Vagas, you know, you can fit the 425s or the 220s, and you can get a little bit extra oomph out of them, but that ASB fits very tight.
The 220 Vaga with the micro warp drive and the long point can pretty much engage anything it wants, aside from some frigates. But like any other hack, the worst case scenario is you just leave. The problem is, like I said, you get trapped where a rapier decloaks and you don't react fast enough to warp out, or you get heavily neuted. You know, maybe they're fitting a faction newt, maybe you get just a little too close, and then this newt takes care of you. And once you lose your capacitor, a heavy newt will clean you out in one shot. Once your capacitor is gone, you have exactly one option to escape, and that is to immediately align out such that the remaining cycle of your micro warp drive, where you're going like 2200 meters a second, will take you out of the neutralizer and point range so that you can then warp off immediately. If you don't make that course correction and you drop back to normal speed, still within point range, you are dead. This has been Declarations Warp Podcast, episode 34. Thank you all for listening. Definitely tune in for the next episode, which is pretty much a huge interview episode with Celine about everything Mercenary Coalition. Hit up declarationsofwar.com to participate in the show polls and leave a comment. If you're listening to us on iTunes, 5 stars, bros, write up a cool review. You can reach Noir via our public channel, CafeNoir.com, and apply to join us or Noir Academy on our forums at www.noirmercs.com/forum.php.
Find me on Broadway.